is Cheryl Fusco Johnson. You're listening to Writers' Voices at KRUU FM 100.1, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. And I am subbing for Monica Hadley, who couldn't be with us today, but I have two wonderful guests. I'm very thrilled to be able to chat with them for this hour, and I think you'll find it interesting and learn a lot. One of my guests is a local. Alan Marks is one of the founding members of JFAN, the Jefferson County Farmers and Neighbors organization, and he is a real estate developer. He'll explain a little about what JFAN does in just a few minutes. He's also the CEO of MAPI, which is an organization he can also tell us about, a 20-year resident of our community. He and his wife, Leslie, are raising three boys, and because of Alan Marks, we're going to have a very interesting woman come and visit us in Fairfield next Wednesday, and she is Diane Wilson. She's written at least three books, The Diary of an Eco Outlaw, Holy Roller, and An Unreasonable Woman, the story of a true story of shrimpers, politicos, polluters, and the fight for Seadrift, Texas. And Diane is a very interesting woman. She began as a shrimper. She was just working in her small town of Seadrift, doing her own thing, and happened to read a newspaper account that indicated her county was the most polluted county in the country. And that galvanized her into becoming an environmental activist and led her into a path of, I think, probably things she didn't expect to be doing at all, dealing with multinational corporations and trying to get them to act in environmentally responsible ways. So I want to welcome Diane and Alan.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Diane has had many accolades since she first set off on this path of being an activist. She has been, her life story has been told in an award-winning documentary called Texas Gold. She's the founding member, the founding member of Code Pink, a women's peace and human rights group based in Washington, D.C. She's fought on behalf of victims of the Union Carbide chemical spill in India. She's also worked in the Texas Jail Project, trying to fight for more humane conditions in Texas County jails, and also has worked for fairness to injured workers. So I'm sure you have a lot to tell us both about writing and activism, Diane, but first I'd like to hear from Alan how you heard about her and what exactly your group does and why she's coming to Fairfield.
Well, I'm a founding member of JFAN, Jefferson County Farmers and Neighbors, and we formed many years ago when we realized that there was a huge push to bring hog confinements, concentrated feeding operations, to every county in Iowa. And as everyone knows, we have a wonderful intentional community in Fairfield associated with Maharshi University of Management and many other people who've come. And we wanted to protect what most people came here and value so dearly, and that is the environment, a clean environment, a healthy environment, and a way of life that was conducive to everything that they and we hold dear, as well as all of the many people who are here and were here before us who have been here, many of them for generations, and have a wonderful way of life and a traditional farming community, and also we have a very a wonderful community here from an industrial standpoint with many businesses, diverse businesses here. But it's clear that when communities are overrun by confined animal feeding operations, the quality of life diminishes and population starts to diminish. People start to leave because of the environmental impacts it has. So we had a group of neighbors who, a farmer came to us. They told us they were thinking of putting one in, and this farmer did exactly what they were supposed, he and his family were supposed to do. They were considerate of their neighbors, and they mentioned this to us, and we talked with them, and because of our discussions, they ended up putting their CAFO in a location very far away from our neighborhood and in an area that would impact the least amount of people possible. But it was a product of this discussion. We realized that we needed to get involved and protect our county. And I won't go real far into this because I'm here on this interview to support Diane and let the listeners hear about Diane.
And when did you first hear about her story?
I heard heard about her story after I got involved with JFAN. And as Diane will tell you, the moment you start to question the status quo, you become unreasonable.
Oh,
and
yeah.
And every excuse or story possible will be told about you, telling how unreasonable you were. And I saw the title, I saw the book, I can't remember now how I saw it or ran across it, but I bought it and I read it, and I was just really blown away by what she did and what she took on, because when you hear what she did, as compared to what we've done, it's monumental what she accomplished in her community.
It is really monumental. I've only been able to read part of the book so far, but I have to say it's a real page-turner.
It is. It's a great book. I recommend it to anyone. It's very inspiring. I think when they come and they hear Diane, they'll be absolutely inspired. It's a great story, and it's true. And
okay.
That's what's amazing, is to hear what she's done and what she's gone on to do as a product of her efforts to protect her community.
Let's hear from this unreasonable woman. So the life you're leading now, Diane, I get the feeling it's not the life you were expecting to lead.
Oh, no, it's not near the type of life, and it's not near the personality I thought I had, because I'm a really quiet natured type person, and I love the bay, and one reason I loved it so much is because it's very quiet out there, and I always shrimp by myself, because the solitude was something real important for me, and I guarantee I don't have solitude or quiet anymore at all. And so when I started doing my activism, I stepped totally out of character to do it.
Well, it sounds like you were always a little bit of an outlier. In the book, An Unreasonable Woman, you describe how you became very quiet when you were in junior high school.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and the thing that is actually, I read a book a number of years ago, and it was by this psychiatrist, and he had said that he believes our childhood, our upbringing, prepares us for our destiny, and I think it absolutely prepared me for mine, because when you're real quiet, you don't have a lot of peer pressure, you don't have a lot of friends, so you seek your counsel within yourself. And I know when I started doing my activism, there was not a single person, well, other than this one woman who worked with me in the fish house.
Is that Donna Sue?
My family didn't. My community didn't. The fishermen didn't. And especially the political structure out there. I mean, it was like a war zone. And so I was fortunate I had that upbringing where I didn't have to have a constant, someone patting me on the back, telling me I was doing right, telling me I should do this. I was used to kind of working with myself about things and doing it because I believed in them. And that ended up being real important on how I fought the battles I did.
Well, that's really interesting, because it was such a transition. I mean, in my mind, when I was reading your book, it seemed like such a transition from being a very quiet person to being someone who's speaking at, you know, at large gatherings and traveling around.
And matter of fact, I remember the first few times I had to speak, it was like I was shaking so bad I nearly fell. And so that's why if people see me speak, they'll notice I get behind the podium, because that's where I kind of was holding on to that podium for dear life, so my knees wouldn't fall out from underneath me. But it's anything. I tell anybody, when someone tells me, oh, that's not my nature, I say, hey, that's no excuse. I guarantee you do it enough and you get better at it. And especially if you trust your voice, because I guess that's where my technique is that I kind of shoot from the hip, and I have yet to plan a speech. I don't think I've ever had one written. And, I mean, I've been in front of crowds that were 5,000 people, and it always worked for me, just speaking from the heart. And
well, speaking your truth. Sounds like that would work.
Yes, very much
yeah,
so.
And it's interesting what you say about you didn't need outside validation because you had this, you know, you were used to consulting yourself.
I really did. I was fortunate in that way. And I know a lot of people over the years, a lot of people that was with businesses and you know, and they saw how, I mean, it got really intense. I mean, they would have counties that would put out entire petitions against me. They would do series of newspaper front page articles. I mean, blasted me from one end to another, and you know, and everybody was afraid to support me or you know, join the group or do anything like that. So I definitely had to be able to take that. And a woman, I remember, she came up to me and she said, "How do you stand all of that criticism?" And you know, and the funny thing was is the more I did it, the better I came to like myself. Mm-hmm. And it kind of fed me. It spiritually, physically, it fed me.
Now, our listeners may not be familiar with all aspects of your story, so why don't you describe a little bit of your life before and then after? So you were already unusual because you were shrimping and working in this fish...
A little old fish house. Yeah, well, like I said, I'm from a real small community. Seadrift has probably got 1,000 people. We don't have a single red light, not a single fast food. The only thing we're known for is the Outlaws. Bonnie and Clyde used to hide out here. It was so far back in the woods. We used to hide out the major Outlaws, and I was a fourth generation fisherwoman. The entire community was a fishing community. I mean, a really working community. And I had 5 children. I've got a son that's autistic, and I was a shrimper, and I spent most of my days fishing when I wasn't taking, shrimping when I wasn't taking care of the kids. And I, you know, at one point, shrimping really, really started getting bad, you know. We had a lot of chemical plants around our community, but there wasn't any kind of attention put on them at all. They were just, like, there. And you never knew what they did, but you would have all these consequences in the bays. You would have these huge algae blooms that would just cover an entire bay from one end to another, and then all of our dolphins started dying, and they were you know, like 300-pound dolphins. You would see them out there in the bay, and you look like a disintegrated quilt, and you'd get up and it was this beautiful dolphin that had just disintegrated out there, and all the alligators were rolling in the bays, and so we knew something was going on. But at that time, all of those major industries in our community, and they surrounded our entire community, they were sitting on the bays. They did not have to say one word. They didn't have to tell the community nothing. If the community said, "What are you putting out there in the bay?" they could tell them to go take a hike, and generally they did. And
No, were many of the people in your 1,000 people community working for those industries? It sounded like
And a lot of the workers came from out of the county. We had a large majority that came out of counties, but also like some of the shrimpers. When they're having a bad season or when they're in off season, sometimes they would go and work for a couple months inside the plant. You know, they'd be a truck driver, or they'd turn a ranch, or be on the bull gang, or you know, whatever it was. So they knew they did stuff, because you know, they would say, "Hey, I was in this truck and we took this big barrel out to this place called Stinky Ditch and we pitched it over, and man, you don't want to know what was in that stuff." But it was like, it was just stories, and you had these ideas about what might be happening out there, but you had no information. You had no data. You had no studies to pull out of your head, and so it was just stories they would talk about. And you know, until I found out, it was the first time the toxic release inventory was made public, and it was 1989, and it was the first time industry had to report what they were emitting. And my tiny little county that was 15,000 people, one of the smallest in the state, we were the number one county in the nation. We had half the waste that Texas generated. The toxic waste was right there in our county. And that blew my, I guarantee you, that blew my mind when I read that. It was inconceivable that we were number one.
Yeah, that's certainly not something you want to be number one for.
No.
But, and yet, it sounds like not everyone was as impressed by that statistic as you were.
As a matter of fact, it was like, who on earth would be upset because you were going to talk about, you know, the all the toxic chemicals in your bays and in your air and in on your land? Is like, who can you imagine would be opposed to that? But apparently, they all were. I mean, the bank presidents, the mayors, the city council, the chamber of commerce, economic development, school districts, everybody came at me with a backlash that nearly knocked me to my knees, and I could not, you know, and I was so naive. I knew zero about anything. But just the repercussions, just people showing up at the fish house telling me to mind my own business and stop what I was doing, and I hadn't even had the meeting yet. They were just telling me to drop it because the word had got around like mercury all over the community that I was going to call a meeting. And matter of fact, believe it or not, I remember I was watching TV and my kids, and they said, Mama, they're talking about you on the TV set. And there was a senator talking on the TV set about my little old meeting. And I was like, what on earth is going on? It was the craziest thing I had ever heard of.
So it is, you know.
I think a point that was brought out earlier is that it wasn't just people she didn't know. It was her friends and fellow shrimpers, because they worked at the plants in the off season to make money. So she didn't have one person standing by her side.
That is right. Not one person, and not family at all. Not at all.
Well, it does go to show what one person with the strength of their convictions can accomplish, because...
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I really do. I really believe if you're... And to me, the key word is commitment. And it's, you know, I think people misunderstand that word, commitment. It's, I remember there was a real famous, one of the Barragan priests, he made a statement that he had said, he said the reason why there's no peace is because there's no peacemakers. Because, and you know, you might think, well, wait a minute, there's peacemakers out there. But he was like, he said, because to be a peacemaker, you have to be as willing to go to those places where your life is disrupted. And people do not want to go there. They do not. You know, I find it such an irony that we salute our children and we're so patriotic about sending our little 18-year-olds off into wars where either if they don't die, if they don't get blown to bits and lose an arm, they come back so mentally unstable that it wrecks their entire lives. And yet, we ourselves, when it has something to do with our community, we're not going to put our finger on the line. We're not going to put our checkbook on the line. We're not going to put our job on the line. And it's like, man, we're such hypocrites. You know, send our children off, but don't ask us to, you know, for God's sakes, don't let us get arrested.
Well, and how many times have you been arrested?
Oh, I've been arrested 50 times or more.
50 times. So you're definitely...
I in what you call a genuine outlaw.
Well, so I'm speechless. I actually knew some of that, but when I hear you say it. But I what I was so impressed by in the book is your writing is incredibly lyrical, especially when you're writing about the physical beauty of the place you lived, and you were going out on these shrimp boats. When you say you were shrimping, listeners may not understand. You were alone in the boat, right?
Yeah, I was alone in the boat. I had a big about a 42-foot shrimp boat, and I would in the rigging and the wind and the nets, and you have to leave real early in the morning while it's very dark because to get out where you're going out into the water, it can be a distance away, and you get there right at daybreak, just as I think 30 minutes before sunrise, you can put your net over, and you have to be out there. So you're out there we used to call them the pink birds, but they were the rosette spoonbills, and they're just they look like those flamingos you see in Florida, and they're just beautiful, and they're rising up from the marshes, and there's the dolphins and the salt breeze. It's just, I just loved it. I always felt like the molecules in my skin separated, and the wind and the water kind of moved in, and so there was no boundaries. It just flowed. Everything flowed together.
So you had sort of a oneness experience with...
It was. It truly, truly was.
So that's the life you were expecting for yourself. And when you talk about disrupting...
And that's the one I was real kin to. I really was.
Didn't you have some problems with your boat at one point in the height of the Formosa plastic?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. They tried to... someone sabotaged the boat and... it nearly sunk on me, and as much as I love the water, and I'm out there, I've been out there my whole life, and been a shrimping since I was 8 years old, I can't swim a lick. So I think the most scared I ever was when I was out there in the middle of the bay, and believe it or not, this kind of crazy squall was coming in, and I had a net over too, and then I realized the boat was sinking, and I had to crawl into the bilge and try to, and the water was pouring in, and it was kind of up to my neck, and I was trying to find out where that leak was, and so I could figure out if I could even stop it, and there's nothing like being underneath your boat, and you've got like maybe 4 inches of air to keep you from drowning, and I finally did. I found out where it had been sabotaged, and I managed to fix it. But I think that was the most scared I ever was, because sometimes on a boat when you get so much water in it, it will just suddenly start sinking,
And that experience. You know,
they were pretty. Pretty frank about trying to stop me.
But the experience you're describing, I just wanted our listeners to know, is sort of like a foreword to the book, An Unreasonable Woman, A True Story of Shrimpers, Politicos, Polluters, and the Fight for Seadrift, Texas. I also want to remind listeners that this is KRUU 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. I am Cheryl Fusco-Johnson, with Writer's Voices, sitting in for Monica Hadley. And with me today, I have the author of the book that I just mentioned, Diane Wilson, who is an activist, and also Alan Marks, who is a representative of JFAN, an organization. I'm not sure how many years ago that began, Alan.
You put me on the spot. I'm not good with years, but probably seven or so.
Yeah, so which is also working for the local environment here. And one of the reasons they're both with us today is because Diane is going to be coming to visit Fairfield to speak on... Why don't you give us the details of that, Alan?
Let me pull it up, just make sure I have it right. It's our annual meeting, JFAN's annual meeting. It's October 5th, and we have this every year, and we have fantastic speakers, and this year we are just so lucky to have Diane. And what's so important for JFAN, it's Wednesday, October 5th at 7:30, is that everyone come out and show, as we do every year, the industrial community that Jefferson County is committed to not allowing itself to fall under the influence of these huge hog confinements. And so everyone's turnout is your voice, your being there is your voice to make a statement and help us and help JFAN protect our community. And so that's why we bring people like Diane Wilson to tell their story, to inspire everyone, and to see that you can make a difference.
And that meeting is going to be at the Fairfield Arts and Convention Center. And it's also free. So,
and we ask for a donation of $5 if you can afford it to help us with our annual budget. But if you can't, of course, we just want you there and you should feel comfortable.
So I think anybody who's interested in activism of any sort would be interested in hearing what Diane has to say. And one thing I'm interested in, Diane, is how you made this transition. It sounds like, you know, you were leading this hard life, but the life you wanted to lead, where you were out there shrimping by yourself, working in the fish house, and then suddenly you become a speaker and an author, and I'm not sure, like, where you could even fit your kids. It sounds like you're dragging your kids around wherever you needed to go.
I've been dragging my kids everywhere. I had this old, actually it was an old Sears van, you know, like Sears and Roebuck, and it had wore out, so they auctioned it off, and I got it for like $100. So I had this old Sears van, and I had all my kids in the back of that van, and I shoot everywhere I went. I drug those poor kids along. You know, they went with me when I met whistleblowers, and when I met these guys on the side of the road, and when I went to demonstrations, they were my best demonstrators.
Well, you certainly gave them an interesting education.
Oh yeah. They still gripe about it, too, trust me.
I bet.
And when you said you met people on the side of the road, I think what you were referring to in your book was that you had to have many clandestine meetings of people who finally decided to help you.
Yes, there was all of the workers, because eventually where I started getting unexpected help was the workers inside the plants would, because there was absolutely no place for an injured worker or a whistleblower to go to. So, and I was at the very long, at the bottom of a long list of people who they could conceivably go to. And so they eventually started coming to me, and but they always wanted to be met in these very far away places, or out in pastures, or out in two or three towns away. And so that's what I'd have to do to talk to them. That's where I'd have to go.
It seems like you must have done a lot of documentation.
Oh, I did. Matter of fact, I always said, if I ran out of occupations, I would be the best private detective in the business. I was pretty good at that. I guarantee I got good at it. And I documented everything.
Now, how did you know you needed to do that?
I have no idea. It's just I guess the deal of it is when I started... When I first started, I knew nothing. So, and sometimes, you know, I guess this is an argument about too much education, because if you don't know what you're not supposed to be doing, you'll just do everything, you know, even stuff that's not something you're not generally supposed to be doing. So I would, when I first started, I went to the environmental agencies here in Texas. You know, the one closest to me was Corpus Christi, and I go down there, and every single solitary box they had, I went through every single file, and the end result was I knew more about those chemical companies than they knew about themselves. And I remember one time that I had this information, and I had, I think he was, what did he call himself? I forgot what he called, but he was next to the plant manager, and he kept following me around. He said, "Where did you get that information? Where did you find it? Tell me. It was like, you know, I knew everything about those plants. I knew every inspection, every inquiry, where they had lied. And the funny thing is there will be investigators, I mean, just regular, ordinary, grunt investigators, and they will write down notes. And that's where I found everything, in these notes. But nothing ever happened to it. There was no investigation. Mm. There was no enforcement. There was no citation. It was just buried deep in these files. And I started collecting all of that information. And when I would talk to a worker, I would write down more until I had boxes and boxes and boxes of this information.
Now, did you have any, I mean, this is just something that happens for many researchers and writers. Did you have any trouble retrieving what you needed from these boxes?
Or no, it's amazing. I have a knack for it. I could have boxes all over my room, I mean, just everywhere, and I'm looking for something, and I know exactly where to go pull it out of. Sure was. And I didn't have a computer. I didn't have a cell phone. sometimes the old-fashioned way still works.
Well, it's sort of a situation where you didn't know that you couldn't do it.
Yes, I did not know that I couldn't do it. And
many other people were walking around maybe as sad as you were about what was happening, but they believed that nothing could be done.
Yeah, and a lot of people, is when I go to a lot of places, is they're like, well, I can't do anything because first we got to get 501c3 and we got to get administration and we got to get a plan and we got to get, and I'm like, no, you don't. You really don't. Now, you can if you want to. You can spend 2 years doing that if you want to, or you can just jump right in. And that's what I did. I just kind of jumped right in.
Well, I'm a little curious about the writing aspect of that, of this. So when did you start writing books?
Well, actually, I have always loved to mess with words. When I was a little bitty kid, I was raised Pentecostal, and they weren't too keen on books because they were like devil's workshop there. And so I would write my own stories, and I had a little knack for it. And I would write my own stories, and then when I got older, it never dawned on me to be a writer, or it never dawned on me to write a book. But I wrote for myself because I liked it. I liked writing, and once I started doing all of these actions, and I would go someplace and I would speak, I would have these guys come up to me, and they were ghostwriters. And at first, I didn't know what a ghostwriter was, and they said, "I'm a ghostwriter, and I want to write your story." And they would just talk, and then one time, this one guy said he was going to write my story, and I remember I met him a couple times in Houston, and he had a big wall, and he put these little clouds, and he had put pictures in them and notes, and then he'd say, "Hey, why don't we go to the museum?" So, this guy had a writer's block, and he couldn't write. So I just said, "Hey, I'm going to write that thing." And they looked at me like, "Now, Diane, you don't understand what it is to write a book." And I'm like, "Nah, I think I can write this book." And I did. I just started writing it. I didn't have a outline. I didn't any of it. I just started writing. I started writing about two single spaced. And when I first started writing, I was writing on a Royal typewriter.
Oh my God!
I would write single space, two pages every day for a year, and I had over 1,000 pages. And
did that become your first book?
That was my first book. Yep. And then I edited it myself, probably 5 times, and then I was a little fortunate because I had I didn't know how to get it to anyone, and there was an environmentalist, and he knew I was writing, and he said, "Well, send it to him," and he gave it to Chelsea Green, which are independent publishers out of Vermont, and they said, "Yep, we want it."
Oh, that's incredible.
Well, people just right on the spot. And matter of fact, every time they finish publishing one, they say, "Don't you have another one?" And I'm like, "Well, I think I do." So I write another one for them.
No, I didn't tell you.
I really do. I like the writing.
I didn't ask you this too much in advance, so I don't know if you're ready. But if you have a little excerpt from one of your books you'd like to share with readers, our listeners.
Well, actually, I don't have any.
Okay.
Ready. but I could. Well, here's maybe it's the prologue to my An Unreasonable Woman. And how much did you want me to read?
Oh, maybe three.
A page?
A couple pages would be fine.
Okie doke. Okay. Most shrimpers will admit they go to sea as much for the silence as for catching a shrimp. At least in the beginning they do. The shrimping was incidental and wasn't what they were really on the water for. If they were lucky, they remembered, but if not, then they never escaped what years of toiling with nets and poverty and bad weather could exact on a fisherman. So a fisherman's original reason could switch like babies switched in a hospital. Then 10 years down the road, a fisherman could suddenly look up and say, "Who the hell is this baby and what is he doing with me?" And the sea that had been the liquid part of his life and had given him balance and purpose and had whispered it in his ear who he really, really was, suddenly was nothing more than a back-breaking job. So I kept my boat, the CB, as quiet and as uncluttered as possible. Only nobody was happy about my shrimping alone, and particularly Mama, who said the water was a grave digger and they were going to find me drowned out there one fine day, just see if they didn't. She told my daddy, Billy Bones, a dozen times a day, "Go talk to that son of yours and make him give her a job on land. Give her a job at that fish house." And Billy Bones said it was a waste of time. He really saw Froggy anyway. And the only times he did was to watch him through the kitchen window carrying out one of his shrimp nets out of the barn and to the back end of Froggy's truck. My daddy would say, "That boy would take my underwear if I didn't have him on." Billy Bones had quit the bay officially, so his nets were fair game. He had walked off his shrimp boat on the very day he had forgotten to tighten the bolt, and all the engine in his oil had drained out and ruined a brand new engine. He was 73 years old and said he would never set foot on a boat again. He was too old and too stupid, and Daddy never did. But still, he pined like a man in the desert dying for want of something. Only he was too stubborn to admit it. Still, whenever I said where I had been shrimping, his eyes would flare like coal in the wind. "That's a good place," he'd say. "I spent the night out there, nearly right on top of that spot." Sometimes when I wanted to shrimp someplace new, I'd get Daddy to draw a map of the area. A cut into Spirit Center Bay, the lay of Panther Point Reef. I'd stick my finger on the paper and he'd slap it away, saying, "Leave it alone. I know what I'm doing. I ain't that old yet." So as resolutely as Daddy had quit the bay, I worked alone. I left in the dark and came home to the kids by evening. It was the spring around on the brownie shrimp, and for several months there was a time and a pound limit. As long as the net was picked up at 2 o'clock, the game wardens didn't care what time a boat got to the docks. It just mattered to the fish house. No fish house wanted to stay open for hours, waiting on a few straggly boats. Still, I was usually the last boat in. After their last drag, most captains hauled their nets on board, and while their deckhand called the catch, they headed for the docks. I didn't know. I sat in the middle of the bay, the only boat for miles, and called the catch in silence. Then I iced down the shrimp and washed off the deck, and after hanging the net in the air with a block and a whip line, I steered for the docks. The truth was I was happy on the bay and loved that it never changed, even when I left. The water had the same smell and the same sounds that I remembered, and it no more changed than the blood in my veins changed. I didn't need to be told that I had went off and danced wildly, then came back tired and weary, and lay down hard at her feet. She was the one thing that didn't quit when everything else fled like a fire was driving them. Okie doke.
That was beautiful. So listeners,
go out on the water?
Oh, yeah. I always go out in the water. I don't have a shrimp boat anymore because that was one of my little demonstrations. I took the boat out to sink it. But I've got little skiffs, little aluminum skiffs, and I... You know, and the water right now, I can almost hear the water from where I'm sitting.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
So I would just want to remind listeners that you've just heard Diane Wilson reading the prologue to her book, An Unreasonable Woman, A True Story of Shrimpers, Politicos, Polluters, and the Fight for Seadrift, Texas. And with us today also is Alan Marks from the organization JFAN. And the reason these two people are on together is because JFAN is sponsoring a visit to their annual conference from Diane, and she's going to be the keynote speaker here in Fairfield on Wednesday, next Wednesday, which is October 5th, at 7:30 at the Fairfield Arts and Convention Center.
Would it be appropriate, Cheryl, if you could juxtapose what was just read to perhaps Diane's work with the victims of the Bhopal accident?
Well, maybe, Diane, could you tell us a little how you branched out to embracing...
It was... I guess the reason why I branched out is it branched out naturally. It's got a way of flowing one thing into another. And I know... And actually, I think that's a lot of some of my criticism about some of the movements. We block off our movements as though there's no connection with anything else. And I have found out they're all connected. It's like the water out there. There's no boundaries. And so I never said, well, this doesn't have anything to do with what I'm doing. I was just open to it. And let it go where it went, and the reason why I kind of flowed to the Bhopal issue is that I have a Union Carbide facility outside my hometown, and it had been there probably almost since the day I was born, so it was out there a very long time, and I remember it had just gotten the Safest Plant in Texas Award, and it was a big award in the Texas Chemical Council, which is all of the chemical plants in Texas. They got a little group there, and they gave this award to Union Carbide, and then about 2 weeks later, that plant blew sky high and sent shrapnel all over the town and out into the marshes, and I think 40 miles away, they were busting out windows from the blast, and a couple of days later, I had this stranger show up in my yard, and he kind of looked like a plant manager, and I was a little bit leery of the guy, but come to find out, he was he was Union Carbide's worst nightmare, and this was a man who had been tracking Union Carbide probably since the day they polluted, and he said, Diane, you want to go to India? You know me, I'd already been out of county, and I said, why, sure, I'll go. And so I did. I went to India, and I had no idea what to expect. I really didn't. I had no idea. But I was just open to it.
What exactly?
I remember I went there about in 1991, and the Bhopal tragedy had happened in 1984, so it was like 7 years later, but it was like it had just happened. The facility was still there, the chemicals were still piled there. It was like they had just walked off from a shift, and the people were still dying. There were 30 people a month dying from the chemical consequences of that release of that pesticide.
And that was from
a
Union.
At this point, at this year, over 20,000 people have died from that that release of a pesticide, because that's what Union Carbide was at that time. It was a little facility in Bhopal, India, and it was an experimental pesticide plant. And because it wasn't making money, they had taken away a lot of safety. They had taken away refrigeration to keep chemicals cool. They had taken away the alarms. And then one of those incidents, they say, will never, never happen, but they do. And there was this release, and this tons of this pesticide went out into this, I think, a 500,000 community. The first night, there's a lot of debate, anywhere between 3,000 to 8,000 people died the first night. They were everywhere, children, babies, families, animals, birds. They said there were so many bodies that the rivers, it was like a log jam from the bodies, dead bodies, it was, and they were still dying, the consequences from it, and this was 7 years later. And I remember, I guess the thing that really stuck with me was not only seeing this, but I remember when I was riding a bus, I was going to speak before this big symposium about Union Carbide and what was going on in Texas, and there was this Indian man who was following the bus, and he was chasing after the bus, and he threw this little handkerchief in the window, and I opened up this little handkerchief, and inside was these, there were like 10 photographs of these tiny, these infants. They were like newborns, and they were these little babies, and they were on these sheets, white sheets, and you could see something, a smear, and it was like, it was either blood or it was like mud. I couldn't figure it. And I couldn't figure out what those pictures were, and I kept trying to show them to people on the bus and say, what is this? And nobody would look at them. And finally, this Indian man, he said, the night of the release, I mean, everybody was running. There was like a mob run, and people were, their eyes and their breath were being impacted, and they were dying. They were just disintegrating from inside. And he said, there was a lot of pregnant women, and they had spontaneous abortions, and those were those babies.
Oh, my God.
And yes.
So is that why they took you to India? So you
those
could...
were the lucky ones. Those are the lucky ones.
Is that why they wanted you to go to India so you could come back and tell the rest of us what was happening?
Yeah, well, they never said that to me, but I came back, and I definitely had a... heart link with those people. And so the rest of my life, and I've been doing it 20 some odd years, I have every opportunity I have advocated for the people of India. And matter of fact, my longest term in jail was because I was supporting the people of Bhopal, those survivors. And I scaled the chemical tower at Union Carbide and chained myself to the top of their tallest tower, and you know, they were not too pleased down in this county about me doing that, and they threw the book at me. I got like 180 days in jail and $2,000 fine, and they were shaking their finger at me every time they saw me. But it was that I will never want that connection is very strong, and it's, and I identified very strongly with them.
Well, that's one of the charming things about you is you have a global perspective. So you see the broad picture. And
oh, yeah, I do. I guess I've always been able to see the big picture, always.
So tell us a little about what you're working on now.
Well, I guarantee you, what you can say sometimes about me is I do the things that they always say you best not do, because when they say to focus, have one project and focus, because if you have too many, you're spreading your focus,
right.
And I agree with that, but I just can't seem to do it. And I always say I am cursed with enthusiasm, because I got all these projects and I just jump right into them. And so I've got a injured workers group. We've got the only one in the whole state of Texas, actually. And we work with injured workers and whistleblowers from the oil, chemical, and atomic industries on the Gulf Coast. And recently we were just in New York, and we formed a national group of injured workers. And right now we're trying to test the workers inside the plant, inside the facilities, for chemical exposure, because you know when you work inside a chemical plant, they say all these chemicals, we don't get any exposure high enough to harm you, and so we're going to let you have like 5 parts per million. It's like you can tolerate that, and all of the workers are dying. They got brain cancers, they got liver cancers, they've got their intestines are eaten alive, their breast cancers, and it's rampant. And so we're going to start getting the workers directly out of the plant and start testing their blood for vinyl chloride and benzene and probably ethylene dichloride. And then that's one project. And then I've got a Texas gel project that I work with. And it is that thing about just kind of flowing with it. And I've been jailed so many times that, you know, and I was there a long time for that one period of time that I realized the snake pit, the literal snake pit that county jails are, and especially in Texas. Matter of fact, they talk about Huntsville that kills so many people. Well, county jails do lots more than Huntsville. And matter of fact, we had one county jail in Texas. There were more people died in that year in that county jail than all those people they were talking about in Baghdad, Abu Ghraib, that had died. They had a lot more in Harris County, Houston. I guarantee a wicked, wicked place is some of these jails. And so we do a lot of work there, do a lot of advocacy, try to help the inmates, try to get publicity on some of the, outright cruel. I mean, there was, like, for example, there was one case. It's like these three young kids within 6 months of each other had all died. And the reason why they had died is because the jails refused to give medicine. If you have a condition, any kind of condition, they will not give you any medicine because they say, oh, you're just a druggie and you're trying to get out of jail. And so they won't give you your medicine. And so the consequences is these three people died. And we had a lawyer. He came to our office, and he came to our office, and he said he wanted to work with us because he had six cases where an inmate had been put into a suicide watch. They were mentally ill. They were in suicide watch, and the guard had went and gave them a rope and said, hang yourself, and they hung themselves. And he said he had six cases. And so that's just a little glimpse of what goes on in county jails. And I'm not talking prisons. I'm talking county jails.
Oh, boy, it sounds like you need to multiply yourself. I think we need to clone you.
Oh, I know it. It's just all over the place.
So I want to remind listeners, this is KRUU-FM 100.1. We're here today with Diane Wilson, an activist in many areas, also an author, and Alan Marks, who is one of the founding members of JFAN, which is Jefferson County Farmers and Neighbors Organization. And JFAN is having their annual meeting next Wednesday, and Diane is going to come and be the keynote speaker of that event. So I'm a little curious if you're working on a book now. And
I've got a book, and it's called Goodbye, Baby Goodbye, and it's I love the fishermen. They're my people, and unfortunately, it's like it's going, and it's just, to me, it's a real tragedy seeing your whole way of life going. So it's about the end of the fisheries, the fishermen.
And so how do you find time to do your writing when you have so many other things on your plate?
I have no idea. I really, really don't. I just, one, I love the writing, and so I squeeze it in because I love it. And
did you write while you were in jail?
No. People would think you could write in jail, but it is so mentally and spiritually a dead zone for a time I really suspected that maybe they were putting something in the food to make you feel that bad, because I remember all of the women that I were with in the cell that I was, is they wrap themselves in a quilt like a cocoon and just try to sleep away the whole time. It's this mental and a spiritual deadness that you feel. And as a matter of fact, I remember even reading where Martin Luther had written a long, long letter, and I'm like, I wonder if he really wrote that in jail or if he wrote it when he was out of that jail and feeling a little bit better. Because I guarantee you, that is not conducive to anything but depression. County jails, yeah.
So would you have any interaction with the other women?
Oh, yeah, and that's where I started the group, because what I did write down is I wrote down their stories. They started telling me stuff, and I would write down everything they told me, and I started collecting that. And when I was about there, maybe 3 months into it, I wrote this huge, long letter, and I smuggled it out, and I had allies outside, and we sent it all over the state to all the county judges, to all the legislators, to all the newspapers, and it was an indictment on county jails. And I guarantee you, we got some attention with that letter, and as soon as I got out, we formed our Texas Jail Project.
Well, so that's sort of another example of, like, several things. One is the difference one person can make, and also that knowledge is power when you shine a light on these different situations.
In every place there is an opportunity. I have yet to see where whatever happens to you, whatever you think may be a bad thing, it's actually not. It's that it will give you information you had never had before, because I had information from that jail time that I had never even imagined. And with that information, you know, we created this whole new advocacy for people in jails. And there's not very many for jails. There's a lot of groups out there for prisons, but there's not for county jails.
So another thing I wanted to ask you, because you're a person who enjoyed a solitary life at one point. Uh-huh. I mean, not completely solitary. You did have a husband and five children.
Uh-huh.
But what was it like to be featured in a documentary?
Oh, I got real tired of that camera. I really did. I really did. Like, oh, my gosh. It was very difficult. I was very glad when the camera left. Trust me. Yeah, you just, I mean, they follow you everywhere. I remember one time I wanted to get in the back room, and I shut the door, and they followed me in the back room. So it was, it was like a painful thing you had to do, but you had to do it, so you just did it because you had to do it, and I did it. But it was not something I would want to do at all. I can't imagine people who are movie stars and have that. I cannot imagine.
So we'll cancel the video camera we were going to have strapped following you around the whole time you're here in Fairfield.
Please. Let's lose them in traffic or something or another.
Well, I think that's all the time we have for today. So we have been listening to Diane Wilson, an activist who's going to be visiting Fairfield, and Alan Marks, who's a member of JFAN, the organization that's bringing her here. You've been listening to Writers' Voices on KRUU-FM. And I want to say goodbye, Alan and Diane.
Thank you. Y'all been great.
Thank you very much. Everyone, please come Wednesday night, 7:30, and support Jefferson County Farmers and Neighbors. And we guarantee you'll have a wonderful time listening to Diane and her life story.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.